All right, welcome back to the podcast. My name is Doug, and I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, and I'm a recovering sex addict. And today is episode 24 of our Castamonia Purity podcast, and I'm very excited to have on the show today Carol, the coach, and she actually will have the honor of being the first female ever on the show. At this point, we've done 23 episodes prior, all males. So welcome to the show, Carol, and congratulations on being the first female.
Well, I feel very honored. Thank you very much.
And Carol, I know that you've done a lot of great work as far as sex addiction, pornography addiction, and really helping spouses, helping families, helping men understand what sex addiction is and how to overcome that. So first, just thank you for your work and the inspiration that you've been even to me personally.
Well, I appreciate that, Doug. Absolutely. I've made it my mission to educate people about sexual addiction. And I think one of the reasons that I made it my mission is that I'm currently the only CSAT, which is the Certified Sexual Addiction Therapist, in the Indianapolis area. Being the only one, I've been recruiting people as quickly as I can to learn the training to provide good treatment and resources for sex addicts and their partners.
Wow. I can't imagine how busy that probably keeps you being the only one in town.
Well, it's interesting because I had an unusual background in that I'm a life coach and a mental health therapist of 34 years. So one of the things that I wanted to do was diversify, and I did news talk radio on Saturday nights called Sex, Love, and Relationships with Carol the Coach, and I did it for three different stations and did a lot of segments for news stations on just a variety of things. And after I started doing that, I just felt pulled. I'm sure it was God saying, Carol, there's a need for this work in sexual addiction. It's so dark, and it probably needs a female. So I went ahead and looked into it, and at the time, there was really only one training facility. And so I always say it took me $10,000 and 10,000 hours later, and I got my certification. And as a result, I have an internet radio show, and that's really helped teach me things as well as keep me fresh on what's going on in the
Absolutely.
World of sexual addiction. Yeah.
And I think that's, I know for me personally, that you know, blog talk radio online program, that's, you know, the podcast has been influential in my own recovery, in my own life. And I know you do life coaching podcasts and really have a diversity in your background. But what I find interesting about your programming and kind of the way that you attack it, so to speak, is that you come from kind of those three strands coming in together, and I think it's really unique and it's special for the addict, as well as I think people trying to understand what it truly is.
Well, I agree with you 100%. And how can people hear your show? Because I want to advertise your show.
Oh, well, thank you. That'd be great. We'd love for it to be on any advertisement that you have. I think we are a growing show and really a unique niche in a couple ways, that we try to stay Christ-centered in our approach, that we're very as a 12-step group, we're very similar to Sex Addicts Anonymous, except for that, you know, instead of higher power, we do claim Jesus. But then in this specific podcast, our goal is to really just have a casual way that we can dialogue with experts. I don't claim to be an expert, but I can ask enough questions to let the experts talk, and then really just to open up conversations as to what it is, so people feel like they're not alone. Because what I found as a recovering sex addict, and what I've found in talking with other guys, is we all felt like we were the only one, and there was no one we could tell. So the more that I feel like I can get the word out that guys that are suffering aren't alone, then I feel like, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate that. And I'm always talking about 12-step work, and I get the difference between using God or a higher power. I know they really try to use higher power because obviously that approach may actually get more men involved.
But absolutely.
I absolutely believe that it's Jesus Christ. So I'm right there with you.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, you kind of talked a little bit about your background, but I was curious, just, you know, when I talk to therapists and people in the business, wanting to know what their initial passion, so to speak, was to get into the, you know, the business of being a therapist or being a life coach. And then is that now, after years of doing that, is that still the same passion that you started with?
That's a great question. And I really believe that for me, I feel if there's anything about archetypes, I am a teacher. I love to teach. I was going to go into teaching as opposed to psychotherapy. And then I felt a calling, and I'm very Christ-centered. I felt a calling to do psychotherapy instead. So when I did psychotherapy, one of the things that I really believed in was accessing a person's strengths and helping them to heal the wounds, which is obviously intensive psychotherapy, but really accessing their strengths so that they felt good about themselves. Well, coaching is all about taking that person to the next level and accessing their strengths. So I really, truly wanted to do that work too in my practice. I knew I was doing it anyway. So I said, I'm going to look into this life coaching. And I actually set up a workshop to learn more about it. And then I had submitted my resume to the only Indianapolis paper. And I wanted to be Indianapolis's own local Ann Landers and help people with their problems. And they said, Carol, we've got Ann Landers. Have you ever thought about coaching? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm in training to be a coach. Now, Doug, that was a little bit of an embellishment in that I wasn't in training, but I had signed up to be in training.
You had the vision.
And yeah, so I got 12 books out on coaching and wrote my first column on coaching and then wrote two others and submitted them to the paper. And interestingly enough, they came back with, you know what, Carol, our only regret is that we can't use these previously published columns for our paper. And I said, oh, no, I customized those for you. And so hence I became Carol the Coach. And I've been doing that ever since. And in sexual addiction, that can be tricky because sex addicts that are initially in recovery feel so much shame and they feel so much self-loathing that even though they may have a connection with a higher power or with God, they really don't believe they deserve it because they've participated in so many unhealthy choices. And so I don't use a lot of strength-based coaching initially with my clients. I really try to heal those wounds. And then when they're ready, we do the coaching too. And truly, it's a beautiful marriage of helping anybody, but especially sex addicts, to feel better about themselves and to start boosting their own self up. Just found it to be very helpful in sexual addiction treatment.
Wow. Yeah, I think that is great. And I know a few episodes ago, I had a podcast guest that said that, you know, he had to find out through therapy that sex wasn't his problem. Sex was the solution that he chose to deal with other problems. And it was a wrong solution, but it is what he chose. And I think, you know, your approach is able to really get to the heart of what those issues are. Kind of break down for me, what is a psychotherapist? You know, I've heard the term, I know others have heard the term, and obviously we're in therapy and doing different things, but how do you describe your work as a psychotherapist?
Well, I always say the psychotherapists are counselors, marriage and family therapists, social workers, psychologists, and then a few psychiatrists who practice the art of counseling and therapy. Now, psychiatrists typically manage medication, and psychologists, although they do therapy, they are experts in testing. So counselors, social workers, marriage and family therapists, they can't do testing, and they cannot do medicine. But all together, we work on healing the wounds that someone experienced either in the past or in their present.
Mm. I think that's amazing. And it's so neat how everyone has a niche that they fill, but it's a very needed part of what our community needs.
I agree.
Absolutely. So in working with so many different sex addicts and working with couples and with guys, and what are some common elements that you see with those? I know you mentioned the shame and the guilt when they first come in. What are some other elements you may come across?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Patrick Carnes, but he is the guru of sexual addiction. He put together FAA groups. He helped to write the book, which, you know, obviously was based on Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I trained specifically with him, I said to him one day, I said, you know, so many certified sexual addictions therapists are in recovery themselves, and I'm not a sex addict. Do you think that's going to be a problem? And he said, no, you don't have to have cancer to be able to treat it.
Right.
The second thing I said to him is, well, I've only got one other issue. Do you think that it may be difficult for a male sex addict to talk to a female? My own bias was they might be embarrassed to share their deepest, darkest secrets with a female, because oftentimes their deepest, darkest secrets have to do with objectifying women.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, Carol, I think you'll find that there's always preferences for men therapists or female therapists, but men actually feel more comfortable naturally talking to a woman. And so they don't have much choice in Indianapolis, being that I'm the only certified sexual addictions therapist. But what I know to be true is that they come in feeling so bad about themselves. They usually are in crisis. There has been a discovery, typically by a family member or a partner, a wife, a spouse. And they've been threatened. You know, the spouse has said, I'm walking out on you, or I can't live like this, or I'm not going to let you around my children, our children. And so when they walk in the door, they're in real crisis, as is their spouses. Half of them bring their spouses that very first time, and half of them come in by themselves. And when I ask them the question, it's so interesting, because they'll say, I have never told anybody this, and I don't know how to get myself out of this. And more importantly, I don't know how to build trust in myself and my spouse.
Hmm.
And so those are some of the commonalities that I deal with. Now, I run a sexual addictions group, and the sex addicts that are in the group, probably 80% of them are married or divorced, and then 20% have never been married. And my married guys look at the single guys and they say, you know what? I think it'd be a whole lot harder to do this work if I were single. Because I've got somebody in my life that's cheering for me and also who's threatening me.
Yeah, you know? There's some built-in accountability there for sure.
Absolutely. And I have to say, one of the things that I do utilize, and it's not in any way to bust, if you will, a sex addict, but to build trust, is the polygraph test.
Hmm.
And so part of treatment is having the addict look at their childhood wounds, if there are any. If there isn't, then this sexual addiction was created by compulsivity. Maybe it was a mental health issue. Maybe they have obsessive compulsive disorder or depression or anxiety, and they started doing something that got very routinized, became very habitual, and then became compulsive. So sex addicts typically have one of two issues. They either have the trauma of a child, or they've learned the behavior and it's become compulsive and now they can't stop.
Right.
And regardless of that, they want the tools and the resources to stop so that they can begin to feel better about themselves. And so I get to work with clients on just that, uncovering what caused the trauma and then helping set accountability tools, whether it be a polygraph test, whether it be filters, covenant eyes, canine, whether it be the 12-step work, whether it be a sponsor. You know, it's so imperative to give them the tools, because working by themselves is definitely not going to get it, nor is working with a CSAT, a certified sexual addictions therapist. It has to be a whole community, a whole committee, as Patrick Carnes calls it, to actually increase the chances of abstinence and sobriety.
I think that is very insightful when you think about the need of community. And just, you know, to steal the adage that from AA, that's our best thinking got us here. When we try to do it ourselves, we just fall so short. And that's, for me, the very first time I had a chance at all was to be honest with someone. Then to have somebody truly hold me accountable, then to have groups where I realized I wasn't alone. And then, you know, of course, to have a CSAT therapist. Polygraphs, I've had four. Those definitely have helped as well. That's a strong springboard to honesty when you have that coming down the pike as well. But having those avenues where there's a full community there and in support of you. So we've actually had a polygraph examiner on the podcast before, and we've enjoyed talking with him and getting the perspective of his heart of why he does what he does and just trying to get men to be honest and to pass. And I think that's one of the biggest common elements that I see in men is that we struggle with honesty as the very first time we come in the room. Do you see that with the men from their first visit to maybe a few months down the road that, I guess, honesty, is it a progression, or is it usually once that bubble's burst, we have nearly all the honesty out there?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, it is not the latter.
Yeah.
It is a progressive mental health issue that gets better and better and better if people are working with the resources. However, you know, the old adage about how do you know if an addict is lying? Well, when they move their mouth.
Right.
You know, you can't have this addiction and not lie. Lie to your family, lie to your loved ones, lie to yourself. And so in therapy, they are disclosing information, but what I know to be true is it's only a portion of what's really happened to them and what they participated in, because they got to make sure you're a safe person to talk to. And they have to build that trust with the therapist, and they have to fight their own desire to lie by omission, minimize, rationalize, justify, and utilize all those defense mechanisms that really keep them from being honest. And that's a process, and that takes weeks and months and years to really develop good communication and honesty.
Yeah, I've heard so many addicts say, and I can personally attest to, that lie till you die mindset of, you know, I'm taking all this to the grave and no one will ever know this. And unfortunately, that's a slow fade sometimes to break through. But such an important one to consistently take steps towards, to realize that there are safe places out there. And I think that's why 12 steps work, is because there's a circle of people that are, you know, just as broken as I am when I sit there. Or, you know, there's a therapist that has heard this before and is there to help. They're not there to, you know, publish it in the papers and laugh behind your back. And so when you realize that this is truly a safe place that's designed for help, then I think then you can share a little bit more and share a little bit more. And I think even as spouses kind of work through recovery, they become safe places as well to start to have conversations with. And that's a difficult thing. I don't know if in your work you work a lot with couples together, but how does that conversation begin to look different from where, you know, maybe the spouse is saying, get out, you know, I never want to talk to you again, to, okay, let's work on this. What are some elements that bring those together?
So that's an interesting question, and here's why. You know, when I work with couples where sexual addiction is not the problem, but there has been some infidelity, those couples are more likely to break up than couples who have experienced years and years and years of sexual addiction. It's an interesting dynamic that the wife generally, sometimes in homosexual relationships, obviously the partners are both male or female, but the wife is willing to hang in there and be a part of her husband's recovery and is the person that helps to hold them accountable. That's why polygraph tests are so amazingly accountable. You know, again, when those kinds of tests are given once every 6 months or once every 4 months, it encourages a man to really be honest, because they know that they are going to be caught. And for the first 2 to 3 years in brain development, doing the right thing requires accountability that is above and beyond what a person has ever had to deal with before. So the couples that I work with where there is sexual addiction, they typically stay together. Now, the trauma that a partner feels, that a spouse feels, is huge. And I should be hearing any day that I'm certified. I got trained in APSATS, which is the American Association of Partner Trauma Sensitivity Training.
Oh.
And I just did my last hour of supervision last week. So I've been in my application, and I felt like I needed that, because as my sex addicts that I worked with got better, the wives didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They stayed terribly traumatized. They didn't want to trust the positive changes because they didn't want to get hurt again.
Right.
And I was really unsure and unclear as to what I could do to get them to let their defenses down and to trust. Mm. And so it wasn't until I learned how to deal with stress anxiety from partner betrayal and post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, I worked with that, but not to this degree, or something called complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which really requires that I teach both the partner and her spouse, the addict, that these reactions are normal and that the men now need to do their work and validate and reassure and sandwich communication with their love.
Mm.
And, you know, oftentimes if a woman has said something horribly nasty to somebody who's in recovery, to her husband, the husband gets the deer in the headlight look and just shies away from the wife,
right,
and or gets defensive and says, I am working as darn hard as I can and you're not even getting it.
Right.
And they begin to battle. And so in working with couples, and I do, I work with couples and I work with partners and I work with addicts, I really, when they understand those anxiety disorders, then the addict gets the proper tools to reassure, validate, acknowledge, and decrease defensiveness. And when they do that, their wives get better.
Mm. I appreciate you pointing that out. I think for me, as in my addiction, obviously it's as selfish as one can be, at least for me. I, looking back, I couldn't have been more selfish. And so even in recovery, there's an element where that's selfish. It's about me getting better. It's about me putting in the work. And then there can be a dangerous line there of, well, I need some affirmation for how good I'm doing now. And without really taking the element of looking at the damage that I've done or the trauma that's there, like you said, that PTSD, and being aware of that, I think there'd be too much insensitivity to her. And so being aware of that, I wish I could say I'm good at it, but even knowing about that there and the trauma that my wife has gone through and going through, it truly helps the relationship to gain just a little bit more trust and a little bit more trust. I always recommend to couples the Worthy of Her Trust book. I think it helps the addict understand what is going on in the spouse's mind. And then jumping back a little bit to what you said about, if somebody's dealing with maybe one episode of infidelity, maybe not a sex addiction thing, that doesn't have as high of a likelihood chance of survival, or maybe anecdotally seeing that. But in addiction, spouses tend to want to work through that. I probably have my own theories as to why that is, but I'd love to hear why you think that is the case.
Okay, so I was sitting there thinking about the fact that, you know, one of the things several of the 12-step groups do in this community is that they actually have book clubs that center on partner-sensitive resources. And so I love the book you just mentioned. Mention that again.
The Worthy of Her Trust.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the best Christian books out there. And so that has been the subject of a book club that actually is in the 12-step. You know how 12-steps are supposed to utilize their literature only.
Right.
So an offshoot of that is that some of these men get together and say, okay, we're going to read that book and we're going to discuss it for the next 6 weeks.
Oh, great.
Or another really good book is Your Sexually Addicted Spouse, which helps partners to recognize, how did this happen to them? What is the addict really going through? So it can go from both directions, you know, where the book club actually helps the addict understand how the spouse feels, or helps the spouse to understand how she got in this predicament to begin with. And I really want to put in a plug for APSATS, and that's APSATS, because a partner can go on that website and find somebody who is partner trained. And that's important. And I bet you, I mean, there's certainly a lot of partner groups in the Christian world. What what groups do you recommend?
Well, we definitely, in the greater Houston area where our group was birthed out of, there's so many couples therapy groups that are going on that are really great. And, you know, obviously there's some circles that deal with just the spouse side, which is, you know, ISA or some of those groups. But there's also the couples ones. I'm trying to think of any of their names offhand. But a lot of therapists also run their own couples groups in town. And that's one of the benefits, I think, of the Houston area is that we do have a lot of CSAT therapists. We do have a lot of group options. I do think that's because there's a higher need because, you know, we are definitely full of strip centers and things that are inappropriate anyway. So I think it calls for a higher need. So the groups are out.
And I didn't know that you were out of Houston, but certainly I just got the new ISA notification from Milt Magnus, and I bet you've had him on your show, haven't you?
I have. We've had Milton Magnus, and we are excited about that telemeeting starting, and I think that's going to be a great thing for spouses to have that telemeeting. I think sex addicts have a lot of different avenues with that. I think you could find one every day if you needed to. But that's not true for spouses. So I'm looking forward to what that can do.
And Doug, I just want to share one other thing. And it's kind of sad. We talked about the fact that probably partners don't have as many resources as addicts. But the other thing about partners is that fortunately some COSA groups, some Essanon groups, I don't know about iSurvivors.org because I've not utilized them. I don't have any clients that are utilizing them, but sometimes they're not the healthiest group. They're not practicing their own good self-care and their own boundaries. And,
right.
You know, we don't want partners to go to a group where they walk out feeling more traumatized or more suspicious or more paranoid. We want them to feel strength, hope, and recovery.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good question for you. Let's start with the spouse. For a spouse walking into a group or even to a therapist, what are some red flags of, okay, you got to get out of here? Like, I've heard the horror stories of therapists that are like telling a spouse, okay, just dress sexier or do this. You know, that's obviously bad advice. But are there any other red flags in maybe a group that they should look out for?
Well, again, I believe that if there aren't people in the group that feel like they are better, more improved human beings because of the group, then they're probably in the wrong group. And what you just talked about have more sex or dress sexier or increase your sex, those kinds of statements that have occurred from therapists, Christian pastors, and, you know, that's institution betrayal or therapist betrayal. And when you feel like, as a partner, you're being blamed for your husband or wife's sexual addiction, then you've obviously been in the wrong place. And when you go to a group and you're wanting support and you're wanting coping skills and you're not doing your 12-step work, you're not working on your own transformation so that you feel healthier and you have more resources available, then your group isn't healthy enough for you.
Mm.
And that's what I would say are the red flags
yeah.
of being in an unhealthy group.
I think so. I think I've heard my wife talk about spouses that are turned away from certain groups because it just seems like a time to go in and share rage where everybody can take part in man bashing. And I understand anger is a part of it and anger needs to be let out. But if that's the entire intent of the group, like you said, there's no one becoming better in that group. And that's true of guys as well. If you're in a group where it's just about rage, or, you know, my therapist early on said, if you're ever in a 12-step meeting and you can look around and the average sobriety is 3 to 6 months, get up and leave. You need to be somewhere where you have some, you know, solid sobriety that you can look towards as leaders in the group as well.
Well, and you bring up an interesting point because I tell everybody, and I certainly say this on my podcast, that, you know, we're all pioneers in the field right now. Although sexual addiction has been around forever, it wasn't until the internet that it became so affordable, anonymous, and accessible. And as a result, and that, you know, really was late 90s. And so if you look at a field that is relatively new in terms of treatment and resources, you're going to have people that may have had slips or relapses, whether it be the addict or the partner who has done well for a while and just almost because she's done well, she can't trust the reality and has setbacks as a result. So I really encourage people to do the same thing you just mentioned, which of course is to work really hard on finding mentors in the community, in the churches, in the parish, in the groups that do have long-term sobriety. There's not a lot of that in Indianapolis yet.
Areas where it's hard to find, yeah.
Well, maybe it's good. They're not going to those groups because they didn't feel they were helpful. But I really do believe in the beauty of groups. I mean, I believe group work is where it's at in treating sex addicts and also treating partners.
Absolutely. I mean, I steal from Alcoholics Anonymous all the time, but they have the I get drunk and we stay sober. It's true. You need to do it in community to get that healing and that hope. I know in one of your episodes, I'm going to read you a quote that I remember from one of your episodes. You said that sex addiction is an insidious disease that is obsessive compulsive in nature. And what I found that rang true with that so much is I think that obsessive compulsive component. And I really just wanted to kind of get your take on that comment being, is it possible to combat this disease with sheer willpower?
Oh, absolutely not. There's not an addiction of any sort that can be combated with sheer willpower. That's what I mean about you have to have a committee, a village to help support you. And for me, I say there are 10 recovery tools, and the first 5 have to do with a group. And I'm sure you can relate to this, even though your group's a little bit different than the 12-step fellowship that I'm talking about. And that is that you go to meetings. And for some people who have a lot of slips or relapses, they need to go to a meeting every day.
Yeah.
And if they don't have a meeting available to them, you know, then what they really need is to get online and, I mean, get on the telephone and figure out what telephone meetings they can be a part of, because meetings are so important. Now, I don't recommend 90 meetings in 90 days to the majority of my clients, but I do say when you're just starting out, 3 to 5 meetings a week, probably it will be very helpful for you. And then obviously having a mentor or a sponsor. And in the 12-step meetings that are in Indianapolis, new people are assigned a temporary until they find a good fit of somebody that has what they want. And then we talk about doing the 12-step work, which means, you know, actually going through the 12 steps, reading SAA or SA, and making phone calls and creating fellowship with people who have really done it. You know, they've done the work, they get it, and they're there to help. So those are the first 5 tools. And then the next 5 tools include meditation or prayer, and reading recovery materials other than the book that goes along with the specific 12 steps. And then reading spiritual readings, you know, whether it be a meditation a day or the Bible or spiritual books. They need to be reading something, putting something into their head that's healthy and that reminds them they can't do it by themselves. They need God. Mm-hmm. They cannot depend on themselves. That's ego-driven. And this disease does not get solved by your ego. The last two recovery tools include any kind of filter or accountability tool that is going to give you some time to make better choices. And, of course, healthy sexual and emotional and physical behaviors, you know, whether that's woodworking, whether that's playing guitar, whether that's exercise, whether that's a Bible study, whether that's dating with your wife, whatever that is, we need those healthy behaviors.
Absolutely.
So those are the 10 tools that I recommend.
Well, that's a great progression, a great set of tools that really seem to create a framework. Seems to encompass, you know, we use 3 circles, so the outer circle, and it encompasses also being able to get to meetings and then use your quiet time to set yourself. You know, I've read the book, The Game Plan, and it talks about every day you're setting 15 minutes aside that's for meditation. That's the first thing you're going to do. And I just think all those components are highly important to recovery. So And definitely appreciate your take on that. As we're kind of wrapping up here on time, are there any resources that are out there or things that you would like to point our listeners to that maybe we're unaware of?
Well, again, in conjunction with shows like your own, I would ask people to go to iTunes and look up Sex Addiction or Carol the Coach, and they can subscribe to my show free. It's called Sex Help with Carol the Coach. That's also the name of my website. I actually have two. One is Sex Help with Carol the Coach, which is specifically on sexual addiction. And then the other one is Carol the Coach, and that just gives you tools for life. I also have started two YouTube channels. I just did a Three Circles segment tonight before I got on your show. And so on that YouTube, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, I talk about, you know, how partners can feel safe, what sex addicts can do for partners, what sex addicts can do for themselves. I talk about those 10 tools. I talk about the three circles. It's just getting off the ground, but I have between Carol the Coach and Sex Help with Carol the Coach, I probably have about 30 videos available to people. And it, you know, we talked about Dr. Milt Magnus. I don't think anybody has more videos than Milt. He's right. Wonderful. But I would encourage them to look at those resources. And one more thing, Doug. I am, I've donated a proceeds to a book called Sexual Addiction, Wisdom from the Masters. They can get it from my website or they can go to Amazon. It is an ebook. And I would ask people to buy that book because every penny goes to research for sexual addiction, and we know that we need more research to get better help. So I really ask your listeners, I say, this is where I beg. I beg them to go to Amazon and look for Sexual Addiction, Wisdom from the Masters, and know that they're contributing to research for sexual addiction.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. So when people pull it up on whatever podcatcher, you know, program they're using, they'll still be able to see that link and get to that. I appreciate your time. I appreciate, you know, again, the work that you do, but you giving time for us out of your busy schedule to talk with us and definitely helping us get insight and helping men realize they're not alone and helping us to look at how we can better serve our spouses and better become better men inside. That then becomes how we are on the outside as well. And as I always tell our listeners, that no matter what the road is that you're walking on, and no matter how dangerous that journey seems, you are not walking on that road alone.